Since we are making a new planet with a new climate, author and 350.org activist Bill McKibben says we might as well rename the place. He calls it Earth, with two A's, and that's the title of his new book. Here he is, recorded at a book tour stop in Colorado on April 27th, 2010.
Look, I'm going to do my best to end up in a kind of hopeful and optimistic place, but I am by nature, my sort of profession is a kind of a professional bummer outer of people, you know? So we're going to have to deal with that for a little while, because there's no use not. We need to figure out just where we are in order to figure out where we need to go. And just where we are is a little difficult, so we're going to go through the valley for a minute, not for long. Believe me, I could do it at much greater length than I'm going to, all right? I wrote the first book about climate change 21 years ago this year, The End of Nature. At the time, we knew most of what we needed to know. You know, we knew that human beings were emitting large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every time we burned coal and gas and oil. We knew that the molecular structure of CO2 trapped heat near the planet that would otherwise radiate back out to space. The only thing we really didn't know at that point was exactly how fast it was going to pinch, how long it was going to take before we were in real trouble, where the red line was. And being human, of course, our hope was that it was some ways off in the distance, because then it would be somebody else's problem, you know? But the story of the last 20 years is the story of learning that that pinch was going to come sooner rather than later. In fact, even sooner than our pretty much darkest predictions 20 years ago. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree. And 20 years ago, we would have said that would not be enough. It's about 2 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface of extra energy. Enough to really change things in a serious way. It would have taken us to the threshold of the global warming era, but that real change, big change, would wait a couple more degrees and hence some decades into the future. And I think by now, scientists, including, of course, all the, many of the world's greatest scientists on this particular topic are your neighbors. I think by now, pretty much everybody has concluded that the Earth was considerably more finely balanced than we realized, and that that change has been enough to kick off really dramatic and powerful flux in system after system after system. If you wanted to date that realization in its sort of final crystallization, summer 2007, all of a sudden the Arctic is melting like crazy. By the time it's done, there's 25% less ice than there'd been a year before or thousands of years before. The Earth viewed from a satellite suddenly looked very, those pictures from Apollo 8 of the beautiful blue-white orb floating in the black vastness of space, they're as out of date as my high school yearbook picture, you know? Actually sort of in the reverse, because in the case of the Earth, there's less white up top now than there was then, all right? I got a lot of calls that summer, some of them from this area code, from scientists I'd known for a quarter century who'd always been worried and concerned and sober, and now were kind of panicked. This is happening faster, and we can see it in one system after another. That was the message. Pretty much every physical feature of the planet that you look at is in that kind of chaotic change, you know? So, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, there's about 5% more moisture up in the atmosphere. That's an astonishing change in a basic physical feature of the Earth. It means that in arid areas we're getting more evaporation and hence more drought. Even more dramatically, it means that in places that are wet, we're getting deluges and downpours like we've never seen before. If you don't believe the climate scientists, ask the civil engineers, the guys who have to draw up the plans for bridges and sewer systems and things. That 100-year storm against which they plan is coming every 3 or 4 years in place after place after place. Even things that we thought 20 years ago were too vast to be materially affected are changing. No one had even really bothered to measure the chemistry of the ocean because it hadn't occurred to anyone that it would be changing. 5 or 6 years ago, when people began doing it, they found that as seawater absorbed carbon from the atmosphere, its pH was dropping and dropping fast. The ocean's about 30% more acid. We already think that it's interfering with the ability of organisms at the bottom of the marine food chain to do their thing. Okay? These are astonishing changes. It's why I called this book with this odd title, Earth with an extra A. Someone asked me today how to pronounce it, and I said you kind of have to do a sort of channel Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's sort of Earth, you know, is the pronunciation. But the point is that it's already a different planet. It's already moved us off that sweet spot of the Holocene that we inhabited for the 10,000 years of human civilization, you know? We still got the same number of continents, gravity still applies, but in fundamental ways, things are beginning to shift. It's as if we'd gotten in a spaceship and gone to a different place. And on that new planet, we're going to have to learn some new habits about how to succeed, or how at least to persist, you know, because it's not going to be as easy. If there really was, as people have said over and over again for the last decade, a flat Earth where things were beginning to move with frictionless ease hither and yon, those days are past. Now, more and more with each passing year, we're an uphill planet where the kind of extra friction that comes with that environmental degradation begins to tell in human terms, begins to tell in our ability to grow food. The number of hungry people on the Earth is now increasing again because we're seeing these droughts and water shortages and heat waves. Even financially, it becomes very expensive to live on a planet where all of a sudden you're having to deal with downpours and floods and things and recover from those, where if you're the health service in a developing country, you're suddenly not able to spend your money on family planning clinics. You're having to try to keep new malaria victims alive as mosquitoes spread from place to place to place. So that new world, I think, is going to take a couple of real changes. The first one is that we're going to have to figure out how to live on a planet where we're not turning to growth as the answer to every question. And that's going to be very difficult. Growth has been our, you know, the one bipartisan fixation of our political system and everybody else's for a long time, because it allows us to avoid making hard choices. But those hard choices are now thrust upon us. 40 years ago, at the first Earth Day, people started talking seriously to Nella Meadows and people like that about limits to growth. And people poo-pooed and scoffed and scorned and said, oh, human ingenuity will always figure out a way. We're now pretty much on schedule running smack into those limits. When you melt the Arctic, that is not a good sign. Okay? And so we're going to have to learn some slightly different habits, and they begin almost with the way we imagine things. Let me read just for a couple of minutes from this book, and then I won't do that anymore. But we lack the vocabulary and the metaphors we need for life on a different scale. We're so used to growth that we can't imagine alternatives. At best, we embrace the squishy sustainable with its implied claim that we can keep on as before. So here are my candidates for words that may help us think usefully about the future. Durable, sturdy, stable, hardy, robust. These are squat, solid, stout words. They conjure a world where we no longer grow by leaps and bounds, but where we hunker down, where we dig in. They are words that we associate with maturity, not youth, with steadiness, not flash. They aren't exciting, but they are comforting. Think husband, not boyfriend. Our time has been marked by ever-increasing speed. Paddle wheeler to locomotive to airplane to rocket, Model T to Formula One. Can you imagine slower? Maybe so. The slow food movement has spread steadily around the world for a decade. Our time has been marked by great ups and downs, booms with the occasional bust. Can you imagine steadiness? Can you make it work in your mind? Most of all, of course, our time has been a time of bigness, the amazing, ever-steepening upward curve where things grew and grew and then grew some more. Economies and road networks and houses inflating until there were entire subdivisions filled with starter castles for entry-level monarchs. Stomachs and breasts and lips, cars and debts, portions and bonuses. Can we imagine smaller? That's the test of our time, both practical and psychological. How can we adjust to the fact that we're not going to get bigger, that the wind has begun to blow harder, and hence we need to lower our resistance? It's not easy to make the imaginative leap. Slow food is one thing, but shrinking is another. The pain of the recession, a word that after all literally means getting smaller, has been entirely real because our economy is geared to work only with growth. By definition, the way to escape recession is to grow larger again. On the other hand, in certain ways, our economic trouble gives us real insight into scale, makes it easier to start thinking subversive thoughts. If there is a phrase that sticks in the mind and in the craw from the last 2 years, it is too big to fail. Giants like Citibank or AIG had swelled to a size where if they collapsed, they could bring down the entire financial system. The phrase, loosely translated, meant the government must bail us out. That's the part we debated on TV and in the op-ed column. Should we prop them up? But the simpler meaning of the phrase was that they were too big. Anything too big to fail is by definition too big. We thought we'd spun a kind of magic that would suspend the laws of gravity. Ever since Reagan, the libertarian economists had insisted that self-interest alone was enough to hold at bay the possibility of collapse. That's why the amount of retail space per person in the U.S. doubled from 19 to 38 square feet between 1990 and 2005. It didn't make rational sense, but it made sense as long as the magic held. The spell broke late in the summer of 2008, and after that there was only poor Alan Greenspan looking less like the master magician and more like the tired, tiny wizard behind the curtain. His belief system had turned out to be flawed, he testified to Congress. I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interests of organizations were such as that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and their equity, he said. And you almost felt sorry for him. I mean, we'd lost our money, but he'd lost an entire belief system. As he put it, the whole intellectual edifice collapsed in the summer last year because the data inputted into the risk management models generally covered only the last two decades, a period of euphoria. On a larger scale, our whole civilization stands on the edge of collapse because the data inputted into our risk management models comes from the last couple of hundred years, a very atypical time, a giddy time, high on oil. It's not just the banks that have gotten too big to fail, but all the arrangements of modern life. Our time on every front has been marked by the dizzying Alice on her first pill explosion in the size of the human enterprise. For almost all of human history, our society was small and nature was large. In a few brief decades, that key ratio has reversed. Most of the time, it's happened just a little too slowly for us to feel it, but every once in a while, there's been a flash. The first to announce it was probably Oppenheimer, watching the first nuclear explosion in the New Mexico desert. He quoted from the Hindu scripture, from the Bhagavad Gita, "We are become as gods, destroyers of worlds." That particular kind of explosion is easy enough for us to imagine, especially after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hence, we have so far done what we can to hold it at bay. It is far harder for us to imagine that the explosion of a billion pistons every minute can be doing damage on the same kind of scale, but that's us, big. So the challenge for us is to figure out how to get small or smaller, how to take a step back so that we're not overwhelming everything and everyone around us. And that job takes at least a couple of parts. And the first of them we already heard a good deal about in the introduction, you know, that work of relocalization that is the key task for all of us in our communities as we figure out how to make this transition away from the fossil fuel world. It's important because it'll help us deal with that, you know, we'll use less energy, but it's also important because strong communities are going to be absolutely necessary to survive, to thrive in the world that we're creating, okay? A world that's going to be harder, a world with friction. We're going to need, for instance, a food system that's not too big to fail. For Citibank and AIG, substitute Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, you know. They're running the same kind of game, a huge, top-heavy, monocultural system that does the same thing everywhere and does it only with the input of immense amounts of petroleum. And as that disappears, as we learn we can't keep using it, then that system begins to crumble. And as I say, it's already starting to happen, and it'll happen more and more and more. The data is very clear that as the temperature goes up, the possibility of growing our main crops the way that we're growing them reduces. Those evolve to this planet too, you know. You can't grow them if it gets too hot, so we need local agriculture of the kind that was being described earlier. Local agriculture, local food systems that really work. And the good news is we're starting to get them. It's not just Boulder. Around America, the fastest growing part of the food economy for the last 15 years has been local farmers markets. Their sales are growing 12 or 15% a year. That's very good, and it's now showing up on the landscape. The last agricultural census from the USDA made it clear that for the first time in 150 years, the number of farms in America is growing instead of shrinking. Okay? And all that growth is coming at the bottom end, the small farm that's devoted to growing food for people around it to eat. Okay, not tossing commodity crops into an industrial food stream where they reappear in some odd form in the supermarket someday, you know. The same thing's going on with energy. We're beginning to see the emergence of this kind of distributed energy network, distributed generation that engineers began talking about. The replacement of the huge centralized coal-fired power station, that mountain of coal at 63rd and Arapaho, with solar panels on top of every roof. I have solar panels all over my roof in Vermont, and hence on a sunny day, I'm a utility. I fire electrons down the grid. My neighbor cools his beer before the baseball game with the sunlight that falls on my shingles, okay? That's good. It's good in many ways. We put benign technology to work. We remove a real vulnerability of all kinds. I mean, this sort of too big to fail system of its own. Even the kind of things that we sometimes worry about now, like terrorism. I suppose it's possible that a terrorist could decide to target my solar panels, could climb on the roof with a hammer and break them. And if he did, I would have a problem, okay? But it wouldn't ramify down the grid. It would be a problem, not a disaster. And one of the things we need to do is contain problems. It would not sort of spew deadly solar particles into the atmosphere, you know, in a harmful way. More to the point, you know, it would remove the need for us to guard the 5,000-mile-long straw through which we suck hydrocarbons from the rest of the world. Vermont, the state I'm from, has lost a higher percentage of its citizens in the war in Iraq than any other state. We're very tired of going to funerals, but it's, I think, a safe bet that we'll be going to funerals as long as the most important part of our economy is under somebody else's sand, you know? And hence it would be very nice to stop that, to start relying on ourselves. So, all of that is good news, and all of it is starting to happen, and it is that first job to which I referred the relocalization of things. But there, I'm afraid, is a second job as well. I wish that I could stop there. That is my intellectual and emotional interest. I would like to be at home in Vermont all the time working on these questions just the way you're doing them here in Boulder. But I'm not. I've been home 70 days in the last year, okay? I've been on the road nonstop spewing carbon behind me because there is another job that we also need to do. And that is at the global and national level to do the political work that has to happen to end the fossil fuel domination and speed the transition away from it. And that will only happen in the time that we have that's useful scientifically, in the 10 or 20 years that we have to make this happen. They will only happen if we're able to do a tough thing, to pass legislation on a global and a national basis that puts a really stiff price on carbon, that makes it pay for the damage that it does in the atmosphere. And at some level, everybody who studies this system knows that that's what must happen, knows, among other things, that it has to happen to allow this project of relocalization to really work, all right? If we only take care of enlightened communities, if we only take our own community and build it and don't do this other work, and we continue to use fossil fuel in large quantities, then at a certain point, it's impossible to transition. You can be the best organic gardener in the world, but it has to rain sometime for your crops to grow, okay? So part of the effort, I always tell people to spend 80% of their effort at home, but to save 20% of their energy for doing this political work on a larger scale that will allow the transformation and incidentally make the work of transition that much easier, because the day that price is attached to carbon is the day that people will be going to the farmer's market, not just because the tomato tastes better, and it does taste better. I traveled 1,000 miles in the last 2 days. I know how I feel. That's how the tomato feels also, okay? Not just because of that, and not just because it's ecologically benign, but because the minute that carbon pays for itself, then you'll be able to see the insane subsidy that currently supports the 1,000-mile tomato, okay? Everyone will be doing the right thing in every place, just naturally. But that is a very hard task to make happen, because there's a lot of inertia in our system, and mostly because we're up against the most profitable human enterprise that there ever was, okay? Fossil fuel makes more money by far than anything else in our economies. ExxonMobil made more money each of the last 3 years than any company in the history of money, okay? And that buys an immense amount of political power, clout, especially when all you have to do is delay, which in our system is enormously easy to do. So, there's something else we need to do, and that's build that movement large enough and big enough to overcome that vested interest and allow real change to happen. It's the most important political effort that human beings have ever had to make. And as I start to talk about it, I'm going to continue to speak with the same absolute confidence with which I've given you a long list of facts and statistics that are all footnotable, but now I'm going to speak with that confidence only because that's what I do. I'm going to move into an area which there is no absolute Bible for understanding. This question of how to do political organizing on the scale we need is not something that anybody, including me, really knows the answer to. And so I'm basically just going to tell you a few stories for a few minutes about how I've spent my last couple of years. And one of the points of those stories is going to be, if someone as clueless as I am about all this can do it, then there is no excuse for anybody else not. All right? Where to begin? Some years ago, a few years ago, I was in Bangladesh, one of my favorite countries in the world. Incredibly beautiful, very fertile, all that. But in big trouble. The Bay of Bengal is rising, pushing salt up the delta. That's a very low-lying part of the world. The glaciers of the Himalayas that feed the Ganges and the Brahmaputra are dwindling. That will cause trouble. When I was there, the problem they were having was more acute. The first big outbreak of dengue fever, a mosquito-borne disease now spreading like wildfire. Its incidence up 200% across Asia and South America. People were dying all over Bangladesh, and it was all over the newspapers because it was new and scary. I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so I eventually got bit by the wrong mosquito myself, and I got sick, as sick as I've ever been. I highly recommend not catching dengue fever. But I didn't die because I was strong and healthy going in. I remember going down to the hospital ward, and there was a room bigger than this, filled with people and lined up in cots, shivering. And my main thought beyond, boy, do I feel bad, was, boy, is this unfair. Because when the UN tries to measure how much carbon each country emits, Bangladesh, the 150 million people who live there, doesn't even register. It's a rounding error in the calculations. You know, the bicycle rickshaw remains the main means of transportation. Most people aren't tied to the electric grid. The 4% of us who live in this country produce 25% of the world's CO2. That means that if there's 100 beds in that hospital ward, 25 of them are on us, you know, at some level. When I sort of thought that through and came back to my home in Vermont, part of me wanted to do more than write and talk about this. But I didn't know really what more to do. I'm a writer. Writers aren't activists. We're sort of self-selected to sit in our rooms and type, you know. And anyway, I'm in the second smallest state in the union. I had no idea. I called up a few of my writer friends, said, here's what we'll do. We'll go up to Burlington. It's our main city, 50,000 people, so not so main, but it's as good as we got, okay? We'll sit in on the steps of the federal building. We'll be arrested. There'll be a story in the paper. At least we will have done something. These guys were as clueless as I. Oh, that sounds like an excellent plan. Let's do that, you know? Happily, one of them called up to the police in Burlington, said, what would happen if we did this intrepid stunt? And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want, you know? And we were like, damn, you know? So we had to recalibrate. And I sent out emails to everybody I could think of, you know? Said, we're going to go for a walk. And we left a couple of weeks later. We left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up, and he's our patron saint, you know. So off we left from his, we walked for 5 days, and we slept in farm fields, and I'd called up all the Methodist churches to make sure there'd be potluck suppers along the way, you know. Methodist sort of potluck suppers are kind of our main sacrament, you know, in the scheme of things. And we got to Burlington, and there's 1,000 people marching. All right. Now, y'all are residents of a big, sophisticated, cosmopolitan place here, you know. So 1,000 people in Vermont, okay, but except for University of Vermont hockey games, this is the most people who ever assemble in any one place at one time, you know. Cows were bolting in terror from the fence line as we went by. It was enough to lure everybody who's running for Congress and Senate down to the shores of Lake Champlain to meet with us. It was round. They didn't just meet with us, they signed this raggedy piece of cardboard we'd been carrying hither and yon that said if elected, they'd work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which at the time was a very radical proposition that only scientists supported, not politicians. But they all signed. The woman who was running for Congress on the Republican ticket had said 2 months before that she wasn't sure global warming was real, more research needed to be done. All right? Well, the more research that needed to be done, turns out, was on the question, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind, you know? And empirically, 1,000 was sufficient because she signed. That was good to see. The whole thing was good. The only bad thing was to open the paper next day and read a story that said, this was 2006, that this 1,000 people was probably the largest demonstration that had yet taken place in the United States about climate change. We read that, thought, Well, you know, it's not really a great wonder then that we're not getting very far. We've got the superstructure of a movement. We've got Al Gore, we've got scientists, we've got economists, we've got policy people, we've got engineers, we've got stacks of reports and charts and things as high as the steeple on this church. The only part of the movement that we've forgotten is the movement part. Okay, there's nothing there. And so we decided to see if we could do this on a slightly larger scale. When I say we, I mean me and seven kids at Middlebury College. They were seniors. We had no money, we had no organization. We started sending out emails to people saying, will you organize something like what we did for April of 2007, April 14, I think. And we secretly hoped that we might organize 100 of these rallies. That would have been 100 more than there'd been, but we didn't say it because we didn't want to be humiliated. I didn't want to be humiliated. Instead, it turned out that all across America, there were lots of people who'd already changed their light bulbs and already figured out that wasn't actually stopping global warming, you know, who were daunted by the same thing that everybody's daunted by when it comes to climate change. I am too small to have any effect on this enormous phenomenon. But who grasped the idea instinctively that working sort of with lots of other people at the same time might be kind of cool. And so on that day in April, we had 1,400 simultaneous rallies in all 50 states, okay, all 435 congressional districts. And it was good. It was beautiful. And 3 days later, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, running for president, endorsed this 80% by 2050 goal. All right. So we were feeling, I think the technical word would be smug, you know, at our accomplishment. Trouble was, and by the way, there were lots of people here in Boulder that did just, I mean, it helped us enormously from that beginning, and so many thanks to you. The only problem was that 6 weeks later, the Arctic started to melt. And by the time the Arctic was done melting that summer, a couple of things were clear. One, our targets were way obsolete. What happens in 2050 is of scant interest. What happens in 2020 is really important, and the change has to be incredibly abrupt. Second, it became pretty clear to us that just as we weren't going to do this one light bulb at a time, we weren't really going to do it one country at a time either. It was going to be one planet at a time or not at all. And that realization, I have to say, was a little daunting because it meant we'd have to try to organize globally, and people don't much try to organize globally for a lot of good reasons, beginning with the fact that the world is a very large place and that all around it people stubbornly insist on speaking their own language, all right? And this makes it very difficult, very difficult. So we were both horrified and elated in January of 2008 when Jim Hansen and his team at NASA produced this crucial scientific paper. It, for the first time, put a number on our peril. They said, we now know enough, looking at things like the rapid melt of Arctic ice and looking at these reams of paleoclimatic data that we've collected from ice cores and things, we now know enough to say what the number is. And that number, the most important number in the world, is 350. In fact, in the abstract of the paper, they put it like this. Any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. That's stern language for scientists to use. Sterner still when you know that we're already well past it. When we walk outside tonight, the atmosphere we breathe will be 390 parts per million CO2 and rising about 2 parts per million per year. That's why the ocean is acidifying. That's why ice is melting. Not a problem for our grandchildren, a problem, a crisis right now. Right now. So it was horrifying to read that. It meant that we'd have to do far more political action than we'd imagined even a few years before. The change would have to come very quickly, more quickly than would be economically or politically convenient in any way. But for our purposes, it did supply one useful thing. That number was what we decided to organize around. Now, on the one hand, it was not an intuitive choice. People don't normally choose an obscure scientific data point as their, you know, rallying cry, better to say, I have a dream or something like that. But Arabic numerals cross linguistic boundaries. 350 means the same thing in Boulder and Bogota, you know. And that would prove to be useful. So the seven young people that I was working with had now graduated college. But that was good, so they had more time. And it was good that there were seven because there are seven continents, okay? And each one of them took one. And the guy who got the Antarctic got the internet because that's its own continent, you know? And off they set to organize. And in our case, since we had no money and no organization or anything, organizing meant trying to find people like us all over the world, okay? Not people who were necessarily thought of themselves as environmentalists, but people who were concerned about health stuff, about war and peace, about development, about human rights, about all the things that are fundamentally called into question by this huge and horrible change. And it was really fun because there were lots of people like that all over the world. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them young. You know, those were the people who really caught on right away and rallied to the cause. We decided that we'd take one day in an effort to really push this thing into the center of public consciousness. And the day we chose was October 24th of last year. We didn't know how well it was going to come out. We all gathered in New York City, the eight of us and some other colleagues, by about 4 days ahead of time to do the last minute tasks, write press releases, that kind of thing. Mostly just to sit in front of our laptops because we told everybody that we needed them to upload pictures as soon as they did in action so that we could spread them around the world and people could see. Now I wish, I'm out of great deference to my friend David, I'm not going to show you pictures tonight because PowerPoint doesn't work so well on the radio, and that's one of the things we're doing tonight. So we're going to do instead what I will call virtual PowerPoint. And if it works correctly, the pictures will kind of appear in your head as I speak, okay? It's a very low-carbon technology that I've been working on. Let me try. We get the sense that this thing might be going to work 2 days beforehand. On Thursday, the 22nd of October, we got a phone call. One of the things we'd done to organize people all over the world was to hold these kind of training camps, one in Turkey for Central Asia, one in the Caribbean and South America. We'd done one in Africa. We did it in Johannesburg, and we brought young people, one or two from each country, down. Most had never left their country before. Most had never been on an airplane. But boy, they completely understood what we were getting at. And we spent a week with them, and then they spread back out across the continent to organize. We didn't hear much from them because Africa, the internet is still mostly notional, you know. It's hard to just Skype people all the time and things. But we knew they were working. And that Thursday, we got a call from these two sisters, 18 and 19, in Addis Ababa. And they were very apologetic on the phone. I remember Aisha saying, oh, we know we're supposed to wait till Saturday, but our government said we can't do this on Saturday. Ethiopia doesn't have the, I think autocratic would be a polite term maybe for what their government is. And says the government says we can't do it on Saturday, so we had to do it today. We just kind of jumped the gun and we're really sorry because we knew we were supposed to wait. And we're so apologetic, and we have 15,000 people out in the street right now in Addis Ababa. And we were like, whoa, that's actually pretty good, you know. That's like one of the poorest capitals in the world. These girls had gone to every high school in the city at the beginning of the year and written their own kind of global warming curriculum. Every student was studying it. They completely understood it. They were completely into it. They understood what the stakes were in Ethiopia, which are enormously high and immediate. They went to work. We said to them, "Oh, you got to quickly get us a picture so we can show it to CNN and AP and make them clear this is going to be a real big deal." They said, "Oh, the internet's down again." And we were, "Oh, no." We finally found that there's one Western hotel in Addis Ababa, and it had internet in the lobby. And the first three people we sent in to send the pictures were too young or something. They got kicked out. We finally found somebody who went in and sat at the bar and ordered a drink and pressed the button on the computer, and we had a picture a couple of minutes later of this enormous throng across Addis of young people waving these 350 banners, and just incredibly beautiful. And we had it up on CNN soon after that, and after that the pictures just started to roll in. The next one that came in a couple of hours later was equally unexpected. It arrived from U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and they'd made a 350 out of sandbags and then posed against it and said, "We're parking our Humvee for the weekend, you know, and walking as we go." And after that, for the next 36 hours, it was just this constant stream. Before we were done, there were 5,200 demonstrations and rallies in 181 countries. All right. Foreign Policy magazine just said it was the largest ever coordinated global rally of any kind on any issue at any time. It was beautiful. I want you to go to 350.org and look at some of the pictures. There are 25,000 of them in the Flickr account from those things. And you'll see many, many beautiful things. You'll see a slight amount of manipulation. There are a file of 700 pictures that somebody put together that's labeled 350 Adorable that all has young kids doing amazing things. Some of them heartbreaking because they're beautiful pictures, but they come from places like, say, the Maldives Islands in the Indian Ocean, where you know these kids will be refugees before their lives are over. Every part of the world, including, thank you all, right here, people making this stand, the same stand. Now, one of the things to notice when you look at those pictures that makes me happiest is that this old idea that I've heard most of my life, that environmentalism is some hobby for rich white people who have taken care of all their other problems, is a complete lie. Almost everybody in those pictures is poor, black, brown, Asian, young, because almost everybody on Earth is one of those things, you know, or two or three. We had pictures coming in from the middle of the Congo in the most remote and war-torn places. There's hundreds of pictures of women entirely clad in burqas and chadors doing big demonstrations, making giant human 350s. There were underwater demonstrations in hundreds of places. The government of the Maldives, the president, Mohammed Nasheed of this entirely Muslim country, taught his whole cabinet to scuba dive so they could hold a cabinet meeting against their dying coral reef underwater and pass a 350 resolution. You know, on and on and on. It was immensely beautiful, immensely powerful. You got to promise me you'll go look at these pictures if you do nothing else, okay? I wish that I could tell you that this had carried the day. We got to Copenhagen 6 weeks later, and this number was on everybody's lips. In fact, people were graffitiing it on every flat surface, you know. We had a great church service that Archbishop Tutu and the Archbishop of Canterbury came and preached at the great cathedral in the center of Copenhagen. And at the end of the service, they rang the cathedral bell 350 times, and then 3,000 churches across Europe did the same thing. It was magnificent. 117 nations we convinced to sign on to this 350 target, which we were very proud of. But they were the wrong 117 nations. Okay, they were the poor and vulnerable countries on the earth, the most vulnerable countries, the first vulnerable countries. The richest and most addicted countries, led by our own, were not yet ready to face reality, to hit bottom, to whatever the expression you want to use is, weren't yet ready to take serious action. And so the meeting fizzled away. And it made me some toxic combination of sad and angry to watch that happen, because, you know, for once everything had been teed up. The whole world was there. Lots of places were ready to act. We had the science that we needed. We knew what steps needed taking. Nothing. So I was in a foul mood that last day. But it didn't last, because we'd brought with us the largest delegation to Copenhagen of any country or NGO or anything else. 350 young people. Were numerical freaks, so we had 350 young people there from everywhere. Most of them had never been a place like this before. Those two sisters from Addis were, North Face had given us a bunch of parkas, and they were wearing two apiece at all times. I mean, they were out of their element in that way, but completely in their element in every other way. They were doing an amazing job. The kids from China, the woman from Iraq who'd organized an amazing demonstration, the people from India who had organized 300 demonstrations across India. I mean, it was great to see them there at work and really talking to their foreign ministers and their environment ministers and their prime ministers. That was how we got 117 countries to sign on. And that day when I was so mad, they were all coming up to me, because they're good souls anyway, and they're all coming up to me and saying, "Well, you know, I mean, really, what did you expect? We've only been doing this a year, and we're up against the most powerful force in the planet, and it wasn't just going to roll over for us. You know, often people from the poorer parts of the world, I think, have a sharper appreciation of power and its meaning than maybe some of the rest of us from more comfortable places. They weren't going to roll up for us, so we have to go and make this bigger and stronger, and eventually we will." Well, they were right. Absolutely right. And that's what we're doing, and that's why I have to ask you for your help again. The 10th of October this time. 10? 10-10. No excuse for forgetting the date, all right? And this time, not a global political rally. We're calling it a global work party. In thousands of places all over the world, people will be putting up solar panels, people will be digging community gardens, people will be laying out bike paths, people will be doing all those kinds of work, the kind of transition work, the things that every community needs to be doing. But we're not doing them because we think that we can solve climate change one bike path at a time. We simply can't. The math doesn't work that way. We have to get these interventions at the national and the global level. We've got to get that legislation someday that changes the economic calculus. And so the message of the day will be not only that we need to do good things in our community, things that I know you all can think of and organize to do, but also that we need to send a very pointed political message to our leaders, which is, if we can get to work, perhaps you could get to work also. If I can be bothered to climb up on the roof of the school and hammer in a solar panel, perhaps you could be bothered to climb to the floor of the Senate and hammer out some legislation, you know? 20 years of a perfect bipartisan effort to do nothing is enough, you know? Time to get to work. And we got to send that message to Washington and to Beijing and to Delhi and to all the other capitals of the world, because we have very, very little time to do it. It's going to be a beautiful day. And if I were a smart organizer, I would just stop right here, okay, and not say another word, because I can tell that you're ready to go to work and do what needs to be done on that day, on all the other days too, but on the 10th of October. But the problem with being a writer, first and foremost, is that one feels this sort of compulsion to tell the truth also all the time, okay? And the truth is, there's no guarantee that this is going to work. There's no guarantee that anything is going to work. There are scientists and good scientists who think we have waited too long to get started, that the momentum of this heating has already reached a kind of a threshold past which it's not really reversible in meaningful ways. You know, the best science, the consensus science, is that we still have not a way to stop global warming. It's too late for that. We've raised the temperature 1 degree. There's another degree in the pipeline, but maybe still time with dramatic action to keep it from spinning entirely out of control into a real civilization-challenging chaos, but no guarantee. And there are political scientists who think that this is just an impossible task, that the combination of inertia and vested interest is just too strong, that the oil industry is just too rich, that it just can't be done. If you were a betting person, you might be well advised to take that bet. But I gotta say, it strikes me that this is a bet we are not allowed to make. Just not allowed to make. That the moral obligation on anyone who's alive and conscious at the moment when the greatest problem that humans have ever faced is bearing down on them, the moral obligation is to do every damn thing you can to change those odds at least a little bit. And so I offer no guarantee that we're going to win, but I offer you the absolute guarantee and the absolute promise that we will fight as hard as ever we can. And it is a great privilege and an honor to be in a room full of people who are already fighting that fight and to be your colleagues and comrades in that fight. Thank you for it, and thank you for coming tonight and listening. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Bill McKibben, author of the book Earth, speaking in Colorado, April 27th, 2010. Find out more at 350.org.